reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Wednesday, June 29th, 2022. I'm your reader, Janet Griffith. We'll begin on the first page today. The first headline reads, Reynolds asks court to restore heartbeat abortion law. She also asks state's high court to set legal standard. By Erin Murphy. Des Moines. Abortions would be illegal in Iowa once a fetal heartbeat can be detected at 6 weeks, often before a woman knows she's pregnant. Under a pair of requests, Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds said Tuesday she plans to submit to Iowa courts. The Republican governor announced that in the wake of last week's U.S. Supreme Court ruling that overturned Roe v. Wade and repealed a woman's right to have an abortion under the U.S. Constitution, she will ask the Iowa Supreme Court to rehear a recent case on abortion regulations so the state court can establish what legal standards can be applied to abortion restrictions in Iowa. And Reynolds said she will ask the state courts to lift an injunction on the so-called fetal heartbeat law that was passed in 2018 but immediately stopped by the courts. The legal landscape for abortion regulations has been rewritten over the past 2 weeks in Iowa and across the country. On June 17th, the Iowa Supreme Court overturned its own 2018 decision that had declared the right to an abortion was protected by the Iowa Constitution. Exactly 1 week later, on June 24th, the U.S. Supreme Court overturned the landmark 1973 decision that had made abortion access a federal right. Those rulings cleared the way for Iowa Republicans to enact stronger abortion restrictions in the state. Now is the time for us to stand up and continue the fight to protect the unborn, Reynolds said in a statement. The U.S. Supreme Court's historic decision reaffirms that states have the right to protect the innocent and defenseless unborn, and now it's time for our state to do just that. As governor, I will do whatever it takes to defend the most important freedom there is, the right to life. For now, abortion remains legal in Iowa until 20 weeks of pregnancy. Iowa Attorney General Tom Miller, a Democrat, announced he will not be involved with the state's request to the courts, citing his support for the legal rationale that the U.S. Supreme Court applied to Roe v. Wade in 1973 and Planned Parenthood v. Casey in 1992, which reaffirmed Roe. Miller also recused himself from arguing the state's defense of the 2018 fetal heartbeat law that Reynolds is now asking the courts to allow to be enforced. In that case, I stated that I could not zealously assert the state's position because of my core belief that the statute, if upheld, would undermine rights and protections for women, Miller said in a statement. In my nearly 40 years in office, I have declined to represent the state in only one other similar situation. I do not take lightly my responsibility to represent the state. Reynolds said the state will instead be represented by Alan Ostergren, a conservative lawyer and president and chief counsel of the Kirkwood Institute, a think tank. Reynolds' office said Ostergren will be retained at no cost to Iowa taxpayers. The top Republican leaders in the Iowa legislature, Senate Majority Leader Jack Whitfer from Ankeny and House Speaker Pat Grassley from New Hartford, added statements of support for Reynolds' request to the court. In 2018, the Heartbeat Bill created significant momentum across the country for conservative states to initiate legislation to protect the unborn. One of those state laws led to the historic Dobbs v. Jackson Women's Health Organization decision by the U.S. Supreme Court last week, opening the path for the 2018 law to be implemented in Iowa, Whitfer said in a statement. I support the decision to put these laws back in front of the court to protect life in Iowa. Zach Walls of Coralville, leader of the Iowa Senate Democrats, in a statement warned that Republicans' actions will be dangerous to the health of Iowa women. Iowa Republicans will not stop until they have completely banned abortion without exception. This is an incredibly dangerous action that threatens the health, safety, and future of Iowa women, Walls said. Reynolds' request to rehear Planned Parenthood v. Reynolds is designed to get the Iowa Supreme Court to rule what standard, if any, should be applied to abortion regulations under the Iowa Constitution. In its momentous June 17th ruling, the state court failed to establish such standards, citing a desire to first wait for the U.S. Supreme Court's ruling on Dobbs. The Iowa Supreme Court, in its June 17th ruling, said the undue burden standard that was the previous standard would remain in effect until the U.S. Supreme Court's ruling, which came a week later. Reynolds noted the undue burden standard was used by the Iowa Supreme Court in 2015 when it struck down a law banning telemedicine abortion services. Thus, while the Iowa Supreme Court's decision was a step in the right direction, it left more work to be done in Iowa's courts to fully protect the life of the unborn, as the U.S. Supreme Court ruled in Dobbs that states have an important interest in doing, Reynolds said in a news release. Governor Reynolds fully intends to do that work. Next item from the front page is headlined, Vilsack, $10 million in grants will target ag waste. Program created under the Bipartisan Infrastructure Law by Tom Barton of the Gazette Des Moines Bureau. Ely. For U.S. Secretary of Agriculture Tom Vilsack, infrastructure is not just about investing in roads and bridges and broadband internet. It's also about investing in the future and inspiring innovation, he says. Like using corn to make yoga pants, or using anaerobic digestion on a cattle feedlot to break down manure and food waste into methane that can generate electricity. At an event Tuesday at Dan and Debbie's Creamery in Ely, the head of the U.S. Department of Agriculture and former Iowa governor announced funding for a program created under the $1 trillion bipartisan infrastructure bill signed into law by President Joe Biden. Dan and Debbie represent the many American farmers, families, and communities USDA is called to serve, Vilsack said. This pilot program is a critical part of USDA's commitment to enhancing the circular economy and providing additional revenue streams for farmers. This program will help farmers take field residues and waste products and turn them into value-added products that create wealth and drive economic development in rural areas. Under the program, the USDA will award up to $10 million divided among the highest-rated applications that include eligible universities and private sector partners. Vilsack said the initiative will help build a bio-based economy in America by finding ways to turn agriculture residue into products for consumers and construction. What does that mean? It means taking everything that's grown and raised and produced on a farm and turning it into something more valuable, Vilsack said. That includes not just the corn and soybeans, not just the livestock that can be processed, but also all of the waste product. He pointed to construction of a $300 million chemical plant in southeast Iowa's Eddyville that will use corn to make fabric and other materials. The project, a joint venture of Cargill and Helm, a chemical company based in Germany, will produce a chemical called Kira, developed from corn sugar instead of from fossil fuels, said Jill Zullo, managing director for biointermediates at Cargill. Kira can cut up to 93% of greenhouse gas emissions when compared to traditional fossil sources, according to Cargill. The chemical is used to manufacture spandex and athletic wear. Carbon dioxide trapped by corn creates starch. Sugars from the starch are then fermented into butanediol, with Kira being extracted, Zullo said. The facility is being built on Cargill's existing Eddyville campus and is scheduled to open in summer 2024. We would sell Kira to the spandex maker, then that spandex maker sells it to Lululemon, Nike, Under Armour, Zullo said. Vilsack said investment is part of the Biden administration's ongoing work to create good-paying jobs, lower greenhouse gas emissions, and boost economic opportunity in rural communities. After getting the initial grant and once equipped with a roadmap for how to create a bio-based product that can become a consumer product or construction material, Vilsack said applicants can then tap into and more easily navigate existing grant and loan assistance programs through the USDA and the infrastructure bill in the hopes of accelerating climate-smart agricultural practices like those of Brian Sievers. Sievers owns and manages a beef cattle feedlot in Stockton outside of Davenport. Looking to expand his feeding operation, but wanting to do so in a very sustainable fashion, Sievers built an anaerobic digester in 2013 with the help of a $500,000 grant through the USDA. He also received a USDA Environmental Quality Incentives Program and an energy grant through the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act. Sievers said the farm generates enough electricity from methane produced from the digester, which it sells to Alliant Energy, to power 1,000 homes. It's really meant a way for us to grow our beef cattle industry in a way that reduces our carbon footprint, Sievers said. We just think it's an excellent opportunity to manage our risk in our farming operation and create another way to generate cash flow in ways we think are very sustainable. And the final article on today's page one, headline reads, Judge tells UI to turn over records in racial bias lawsuit. Rejects notion that football program reports are secret. By Vanessa Miller. Iowa City. University of Iowa Athletics must turn over all materials former players have requested from an independent and external review of the Hawkeye football program, including reports on specific coaches, despite UI assertions the records are subject to attorney-client privilege and should be private. It is uncontested that the Hush-Blackwell law firm's investigation was not made and the report was not prepared because of any prospect of litigation, according to Chief U.S. Magistrate Judge Helen Adams' June 24th order in the federal lawsuit that several former Hawkeye football players filed in October 2020 against the UI, the State Board of Regents, head football coach Kirk Ferentz, and others. Referencing the UI's decision to hire national law firm Hush Blackwell LLP to consult an independent and external review of the program, following allegations it enabled racially motivated discrimination, Adams ordered the UI to release all its findings, not just the parts it wants. The Hush-Blackwell documents came into existence well in advance of the plaintiff's lawsuit, she wrote. The defendants could not possibly have prepared the HB documents in anticipation of litigation when no such prospects of litigation existed. As such, the HB documents are not privileged. The UI in early 2020 hired the firm to investigate the football program's culture after numerous former players went public with allegations of racism and discrimination, leading the UI's $1.3 million separation deal with former strength coach Chris Doyle among those accused. As part of its review, Hush-Blackwell interviewed current and former players and employees and produced a report confirming the program perpetuated racial or cultural biases and diminished the value of cultural diversity. The university publicly released one report on the findings in July 2020, and a group of former players subsequently filed a federal lawsuit, which has brought accusations of harassment, intentional delays, and bad faith from one side or the other. In seeking documents to build their case, player attorneys have asked the UI to turn over hundreds of thousands of pages of records, including all documents associated with the Hush-Blackwell investigation. The university, in withholding records, has argued they either don't exist or are protected by privilege and privacy laws. Documents players want include Doyle's performance evaluations and Hush-Blackwell personnel reports on Ferentz, assistant coaches Brian Ferentz and Seth Wallace, and Doyle. To the university's argument of attorney-client privilege, Adam wrote, "That's a long-established rule that confidential communications between an attorney and his client are absolutely privileged from disclosure against the will of the client." According to Adam's order, though, attorney-client privilege applies only to those disclosures necessary to obtain informed legal advice which might not have been made absent the privilege. In order for the attorney-client privilege to be applicable, the parties to the communication in question must bear the relationship of attorney and client, according to the order. A communication is not privileged simply because it is made by or to a person who happens to be a lawyer. Finding that the UI failed to show it engaged Hush-Blackwell to provide legal services, Adams wrote the fact the investigation was conducted by an attorney is irrelevant. There's nothing in the record to support the argument that the HB law firm provided any advice to Iowa for the purpose of an opinion on law, in anticipation of litigation, in preparation for trial, or any other service which only a lawyer is authorized to perform, she wrote. Plus, she said, when the UI made one part of Hush-Blackwell's work public, it must make all its reports public. This court holds that Iowa waived attorney-client privilege when it voluntarily disclosed the report to the public, her order said. And, the judge found, because the UI has indicated it plans to use the report as part of its defense in the player's lawsuit, it would be unfair to allow defendants to use the HB materials as both a sword and a shield. Among the judge's orders, UI must produce much of the requested documents, including the Hush-Blackwell reports, to the player attorneys by July 11th. Moving to local news in the inside pages of the paper, Navigator CO2 Pipeline sets public meetings. Changed route means more counties are added to the schedule, by Aaron Jordan. Iowans whose property may be in the path of the proposed Navigator Heartland Greenway carbon dioxide pipeline are invited to informational meetings in 12 counties, including Delaware, Buchanan, Fayette, and Bremer. The Iowa Utilities Board on Tuesday approved 12 county meetings August 22nd through September 21st, followed by a virtual meeting September 21st. These meetings are required by law before Navigator may negotiate with landowners about easements to build a 1,300-mile pipeline that would transport pressurized CO2 from ethanol plants in Iowa to an underground sequestration site in southern Illinois. Navigator, a Texas company, in October proposed a pipeline to pass through 36 Iowa counties and held informational meetings in those counties November through January. But the company changed part of its route, dropping Linn County from the path, when ADM announced it would partner with Wolf Carbon Solutions to build a separate pipeline to connect with ADM ethanol plants in Cedar Rapids and Clinton. Navigator announced a deal earlier this month with POET, which operates 33 bioprocessing facilities across 8 states, including Iowa. Navigator will collect CO2 from 18 POET plants in Iowa, Nebraska, and South Dakota as part of the pipeline project. The main trunk line that carves a diagonal line from northwest to southeast Iowa now will have a lateral line from around the midpoint of the state east to the Dyersville area. That's why there are new informational meetings in Fayette, Brammer, Buchanan, and Delaware counties. Other counties may have had meetings in the first round, but the route has changed slightly, and a new set of landowners is potentially affected, Elizabeth Burns Thompson, Vice President of Government and Public Affairs for Navigator, told the Gazette earlier this month. Navigator officials and a representative from the Iowa Utilities Board will be available at each meeting to answer questions. Navigator also will have parcel-specific maps for each landowner on the route that will be distributed once the meeting is adjourned. The Navigator project is one of 3 proposed CO2 pipelines through Iowa. In addition to the ADM Wolf project, Summit Carbon Solutions wants to build a 2,000-mile pipeline that would end at a sequestration site in North Dakota. Storing greenhouse gases in underground rock formations could help reduce the impacts of climate change, which is why the federal government is offering tax credits. But there still are questions about how the relatively new technology would work. Hundreds of Iowa landowners, county boards of supervisors, and environmental groups have opposed use of eminent domain to force easements to build CO2 pipelines. The pipeline companies have said they plan to get voluntary easements, but it's unclear how many Iowans have signed financial deals so far. Prosecutors trying to extradite man accused in CR nightclub shooting. They're obtaining a governor's warrant to bring back man to face charges in one of the 2 fatal shootings, by Trish Mahaffey. Cedar Rapids. The second man arrested in the deadly shooting at the Taboo nightclub and lounge in April remains in an Illinois prison on a parole violation, and Illinois authorities have refused to return him to Iowa despite a signed waiver of extradition. Linn County Attorney Nick Maybanks said Tuesday his office is taking all the legal avenues to bring Dimione Walker, 29, of Cedar Rapids, back to Iowa to face pending charges of first-degree murder, intimidation with a dangerous weapon, going armed with intent, and felon in possession of a firearm. The office is now obtaining a governor's warrant and is working with Iowa and Illinois coordinators to expedite Walker's return. Walker is being held at Stateville Prison in Joliet, Illinois, on parole violations for possession of a weapon. In the nightclub incident, Walker is accused of fatally shooting Michael Valentine, 25, of Cedar Rapids on April 10th. The complaint, which will provide details of the charges for Walker, isn't in public records because he won't be formally charged until he has had an initial appearance in Linn County District Court, Maybanks said. On advice from the Iowa Attorney General's office, Maybanks and the prosecutor handling this case filed the trial information, which includes the charges and witnesses in the case and is authorized by the county attorney and approved by a judge. Walker, who served time in an Iowa prison, has a criminal history in Iowa and Illinois, starting with juvenile cases in Johnson County involving theft and drugs, which were filed between 2006 and 2010. He also had several adult cases in Johnson County involving theft and drugs starting in 2011. Some of the cases were dismissed, and Walker pleaded guilty to other cases and was sentenced to probation for them. In 2017, he was involved in 2 more criminal cases, but those charges were dropped as part of a plea deal in which he pleaded guilty to trafficking a stolen weapon used in a crime. Walker was sentenced in 2018 to 5 years in prison, and he was released in September 2019 with credit for the time he had already served in jail during the court process, according to the Iowa Department of Corrections. He was discharged from work release in April 2020. Timothy Rush also has been charged and is accused of fatally shooting Nicole Owens, 35, his girlfriend and mother of his 1-year-old daughter, and seriously injuring Marvin Cox, who was shot in the head at Taboo on April 10th. Rush was working security at Taboo the night of the shooting, his lawyer said in April during a bail review hearing. Valentine and Owens, both of Cedar Rapids, were at the club to celebrate a birthday of a mutual friend when the shooting broke out just before 1:30 a.m. Rush has pleaded not guilty to 15 charges in Linn County District Court. second-degree murder, 3 counts of willful injury causing serious injury, intimidation with a dangerous weapon, 3 counts of reckless use of a firearm causing serious injury, 3 counts of willful injury causing bodily injury, 3 counts of reckless use of a firearm causing bodily injury, and felon in possession of a firearm. He fired intentionally and indiscriminately with what police believe was a 9mm handgun into the large crowd at the club, according to the complaint. After further investigation, an amended complaint states Rush also shot Alasia Cotton and Michaela Stokes, causing them serious injuries, and Trenise Worley, Denise Triplett, and Richard Nixon, who suffered bodily injuries. The complaint stated 10 people were shot, but does not name the other victims. Rush remains in jail on a $1.5 million bond. His trial is set for March 28th. See Art of Hold open house today to get feedback on skate park relocation. Skate park must move to accommodate work on flood control system. By Marissa Payne. Cedar Rapids. The City of Cedar Rapids is holding an open house this evening for input on the relocation of the skate park at Riverside Park, which will be moved for construction of a segment of the flood control system. The open house will be from 5 to 7 p.m. today at City Services Center, 515th Avenue Southwest, according to a news release. Skate park and park users, neighbors, city council members, and interested residents may attend and share feedback on the orientation, layout, flow of the relocated skate park, and features that must be replaced. The detention basin at Riverside Park will displace the existing playground and skate park equipment. The playground will be replaced, but has been removed to make way for work in the basin. The skate park, the city's first, will be removed after Labor Day. The city plans to do a like-for-like replacement of the skate park with concrete in line with current standards. The skate park and playground are slated to be complete by summer 2023. The Czech Village 12th Avenue Southwest Riverside Park Detention Basin project includes the first phase of a $20 million detention basin pump station and flood wall project adjacent to the National Czech and Slovak Museum and Library. Detention basins help reduce the capacity of pumping equipment through the flood control system, allowing rainwater from storm sewers to be stored when there is heavy rainfall. In a flood, water can then be pumped over the flood wall. Cedar Rapids is refreshing its greenway plans this fall to include the newest alignment of the $750 million flood control system. Part of that plan includes a large destination skate park. There will be opportunity for public feedback as the greenway plans are updated. Regents make $339,000 in gifts to Republicans since 2019. Barker, Richards, and new Regent Ryswick are biggest donors. By Vanessa Miller, Iowa City. Members who currently serve on Iowa's Board of Regents have made monetary and in-kind political donations totaling nearly $339,500 since 2019, primarily to Republicans, with the majority going either to Governor Kim Reynolds, who makes appointments to the board, or to the Republican Party of Iowa. Iowa Code requires the 9-member board governing the state's public universities to have gender and political balance, meaning it can't have more than 5 members of the same gender or political party. The current board includes 5 women and 4 men, with 5 reporting Republican affiliation, 3 identifying as independent, and 1, Nancy Dunkel, marked a Democrat. State law doesn't restrict or regulate Regent political giving. Neither does Regent policy, which does restrict conflicts of interest largely related to employment, ownership, or service on another board that might have a relationship with a Regent university. The duty of loyalty requires Regents to exercise their powers and duties in the interests of the board and its institutions and not in the Regent's own interest or in the interest of another person or organization, according to board policy. Regents and institutional officials must endeavor to remain free from the influence of or appearance of any conflicting interest in acting on behalf of the board or a Regent institution. Most of the 2019 to date political contributions from current board members have come from 3 Regents, President Michael Richards, David Barker, and James J.C. Ryswick, appointed last week. Ryswick, since 2020, has given Reynolds $59,517. $39,517 of which were in-kind donations in the form of flights. His father, Christopher Ryswick, gave Reynolds $35,807 in 2020, including a $25,807 flight, plus thousands more to Reynolds and former Governor Terry Branstad in previous years. Barker, a partner in Iowa City-based Barker Companies, which manages and develops apartments and real estate, was appointed to the board in 2019 and has donated $250,180 in monetary and in-kind donations to Republicans since that year. Those include $18,388 in in-kind donations in the form of flights, food, and parking, according to public records. Board President Richards, since 2019, has given $28,552 to Republicans. The Board of Regents is comprised of citizen volunteers, and any political contributions are made in their personal capacity, board spokesman Josh Lehman told the Gazette. Lehman didn't answer questions about board policies on potential biases or specific questions about the Regents donating flights to Reynolds and other Republicans, including whether the governor requested those flights or if the Regents first offered them. State records don't provide details of the donated flights beyond dates the gifts occurred. Ryswick, who Reynolds last week appointed to replace former Regent Milt Dakovich after he died of cancer in February, made the most recent flight donation to the governor on March 3rd, a trip valued at $21,600, according to state records. Although neither the board nor the governor's office provided details of that donation, a Learjet owned by Seneca Companies, a Des Moines-based petroleum services business where Ryswick serves as president, flew that afternoon from Des Moines to Scottsdale, Arizona. It did not return that day. Ryswick also donated flights in 2021 to Reynolds on October 27th and August 12th. On the October date, the Seneca plane flew from Des Moines to Prairie du Chien, Wisconsin, and back. On the August date, it flew from Des Moines to Dubuque and back. Regent Barker's in-kind donations included flights on April 23rd for State Senator Roby Smith, Republican of Davenport, former Republican Representative Marianne Hanusa, who was running for state auditor, Brenna Byrd, Republican candidate for Iowa Attorney General, Republican Iowa Agriculture Secretary Mike Naig, and Reynolds. Combined, that flight donation amounted to $3,543.65. Excited to travel the state and visit with friends at Iowa GOP district conventions today, Naig wrote in an April 23rd tweet, sharing a picture of himself with Smith, Hanusa, Byrd, Reynolds, Secretary of State Paul Pate, and U.S. Senator Joni Ernst. Folks are energized and geared up to get Republicans elected up and down the ticket, from the U.S. Senate to the State House, Naig wrote on Twitter. On May 12th, Barker donated a flight to Pate, a Republican up for re-election this year. On July 27, 2021, Barker donated $2,542.37 in fundraiser food and parking to Reynolds, who faces re-election this year. Although Reynolds appoints regents, each must be confirmed by a two-thirds Iowa Senate vote. Among regent duties, the board hires presidents of the public universities, sets tuition, makes admission rules, manages campus properties, including approving building projects, and oversees University of Iowa Healthcare, the state's largest hospital system. Lawmakers in recent years have fallen far short of meeting the board's funding requests. For the upcoming budget year, which starts Friday, the board requested a funding increase of $22.1 million and instead saw it tick up by $6.2 million. Grassley banned from entering Russia. Russians add Iowa U.S. Senator to list of over 900 Americans it won't admit to their country. By Brianne Fannin-Steele of the Des Moines Register. Russia on Tuesday added Iowa U.S. Senator Chuck Grassley, Republican of Iowa, to a list of more than 900 prominent Americans banned from entering the country as the U.S. government continues to levy sanctions following Russia's invasion of Ukraine. The Russian Foreign Ministry announced bans against Grassley, First Lady Jill Biden, and about two dozen others Tuesday. Grassley was not among the 963 politicians, celebrities, and business executives blacklisted in May, but the rest of Iowa's congressional delegation was previously banned. Grassley tweeted Tuesday that he considers the ban to be a badge of honor as people are needlessly dying because of Putin's unjustified war. "I've been invited to Russia four times while in the Senate," he said in the tweet. "I don't have plans to go again, so Putin sanctioning me is no big deal." The Hill reported that White House National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan told reporters traveling aboard Air Force One on Tuesday that the Russian capacity for these kinds of cynical moves is basically bottomless, so it probably shouldn't come as a surprise to any of us that they would do something like this. Iowa U.S. Senator Joni Ernst said in May that she considers getting sanctioned by an autocratic murderous thug a pretty clear sign that I'm doing something right. Vladimir Putin's lawless, unprovoked, and horrific war on Ukraine will be remembered by history as a despicable and unforgiving act, she said in the statement. Putin can put my name at the top of his list. The updated list was published following President Joe Biden's meeting with the Group of Seven in Europe. The G7 nations are moving closer to capping the price that countries can pay for Russian oil, a senior U.S. official said. You are listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Wednesday, June 29, 2022, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. Carolyn K. Harden Connor, 80, of Marion, Iowa, passed away June 27, 2022, at the Dennis and Donna Aldorf Hospice House of Mercy. A visitation will be held at the Cedar Memorial Chapel Stateroom on Friday, July 1st from 4 to 7 p.m. Carolyn was born on April 10th, 1942 in Monticello, Iowa, to Roy and Wilma Harden. Carolyn graduated from Manchester High School and went on to earn her two-year degree at Coe College. She worked as a legal assistant for many years. Carolyn married John T. Connor on February 17, 1990 in Maui, Hawaii. They loved to travel the world and lived in Minneapolis for a while, as well as Arizona for a short time. Carolyn and John wanted to return to Iowa and be closer to her children, 13 grandchildren, and 4 great-grandchildren. Carolyn enjoyed playing the piano, classical music, golfing, and dancing with a competitive dance team in her 60s. Carolyn also was a deaconess at the UCC Congregational Church in Anamosa, Iowa. She was very kind and generous and loved spending time with her family. Memorial contributions may be directed to the family. Dennis Tamer, of 78, of Council Bluffs, passed away June 26, 2022. He was born May 18, 1944, to the late Joseph and Pauline Kappas Tamer in Anamosa, Iowa. Denny proudly served his country in the United States Army and the Navy Reserves. He was a member of St. Peter's Catholic Church in Council Bluffs. In addition to his parents, he was preceded in death by two brothers, James Tamer and Louis Tamer. Dennis is survived by his wife, Barbara Tamer, children, Sarah, Jaime, Juarez, Nathan, Felicia Tamer, and Damian, Jennifer Tamer, siblings, Gary, Phyllis Tamer, Mary Jo, Dale Noyes, and Randy, Pam Tamer, grandchildren, Josephine Tamer, Jeannie Tamer, Ismael Juarez, and Ethan Tamer, nieces, nephews, and cousins. Mass of Christian burial will be held at 10 a.m. at St. Peter's Catholic Church, 1 Bluff Street in Council Bluffs, on Friday, July 1st, 2022. Visitation will be at the church during the hour prior to the service. Graveside service will be held at 11 a.m. at Holy Cross Cemetery in Anamosa, Iowa, on Saturday, July 2nd, 2022. The family will direct memorials. Charles T. Hardy, scientist, finance professional, and inventor in the pharmaceutical industry, died on June 26, 2022 at his mother's home in Iowa City, Iowa. He graduated from the University of Iowa with a B.S. in 1986 and M.B.A. in 1998, from the University of Washington with an M.S. in 1989 and Ph.D. in 1993. For years, Dr. Hardy was employed by life science companies or as a consultant. He was the inventor of a series of technologies for intercellular drug delivery. Charles is survived by his brother Matthew, niece Christine, and mother Dolores Nadine. He was preceded in death by his father, James C., and brother, Alan Jr. Graveside services will be held at 11 a.m. Tuesday, July 5th, 2022 at Oakland Cemetery in Iowa City. To share a thought, memory, or condolence, please visit Gay and Chia Funeral Home and Cremation Service website at gayandchia.com. Coco N. Bryant, 37, of Cedar Rapids, died Friday, June 24th, 2022 at the Dennis and Donna Aldorf Hospice House of Mercy. Celebration of Life service will be at 1 p.m. Saturday, July 2nd, 2022 at Brosh Chapel and the Ava Center in Cedar Rapids, located at 2121 Bowling Street Southwest. Coco was born October 1st, 1984 in Cedar Rapids, the daughter of Terry and Cora Watkins Bryant. She graduated from Cedar Rapids Washington High. She earned degrees from Upper Iowa University as well as her master's degree from Buena Vista University. Coco worked for UAY as a youth counselor. She enjoyed reading, Pilates, yoga, and most of all, spending time with her family. She had a free spirit, was well known for her positive outlook, and cared deeply for others. Memorials may be directed to the family. Online condolences may be expressed to the family at broshchapel.com. David Paul Maines, 75, of Cedar Rapids, died Friday, June 24, 2022, at home surrounded by his family. Services, 11 a.m., Thursday, June 30, 2022, at First Open Bible, 1911 E Avenue Northwest, Cedar Rapids, where a visitation will begin at 10 a.m. until service time. Iowa Cremation is in charge of the arrangements. See full obit at iowacremation.com. Jack Seward Sr., 92, of Wellman, died Sunday, June 26, 2022, at Parkview Home in Wellman. His body has been cremated, and the family will greet friends from 2 to 5 p.m. on Saturday, July 9, 2022, at the Wellman Fire Department. A memorial fund has been established for the Wellman Volunteer Fire Department. Jack was born March 2, 1930, in Cook County Hospital in Chicago, Illinois, the son of John and Gladys Mitchell Pfister, and was later adopted by his aunt and uncle, Wilbert and Mary Mitchell Seward. He graduated from Wellman High School in 1948 and served in the United States Coast Guard from 1948 to 1950. On December 31, 1953, he was united and married to Juanita Coons. He was in the parts department at Wade Company for several years and worked at and was a part owner in Zips Welding and Repair. In 1953, Jack joined the Wellman Volunteer Fire Department and was currently still a member. He enjoyed camping and collecting and restoring antique international tractors and gas engines. For many years, he traveled to the Old Threshers Reunion and displayed his tractors and gas engines. Victoria Jean Lurch von Stein, 69, of Cedar Rapids, died at Unity Point St. Luke's Hospital on Sunday, June 26, 2022, following a short illness. A celebration of life will be held from noon to 3 p.m. on Saturday at Tien Funeral Home. Victoria was born on August 31, 1952, in Iowa City, the daughter of David and Lori Mearson Schmidt. She married Donald Lurch on September 18, 1971, in Cedar Rapids. They were later divorced but remained friends. Vicki worked in home health care and as a secretary for Dave Schmidt Construction. Vicki enjoyed nature and camping and had a deep love for her family and animals. She always strived to be beautiful. Vicki was an attractive woman both inside and out, and she will be dearly missed. Memorials may be directed to the family. James Jim Hastings Riddell, 90, of Anamosa, Iowa, passed away suddenly on Saturday, June 25, 2022. Celebration of Life services will be held at the First Congregational United Church of Christ in Anamosa on July 7, 2022. Visitation will begin at 1 p.m. with services to follow at 2 p.m. and light refreshments after. Jim was born February 19, 1932, in Cedar Rapids, the son of Arthur and Alice Riddell. He attended Franklin High School and went on to earn his bachelor's degree from Coe College and his master's degree from Northwest Missouri State University. He was a standout multi-sport athlete. Jim enjoyed a long, successful career as a teacher, coach, and overall life mentor to so many. He enriched the lives of everyone who knew him, including students, players, fellow teachers and coaches, friends, and community members, but most of all, his enormous blended family. He married his high school sweetheart, Joanne L. Pinckney, in September 1951, and together they had four beautiful children, Denny, Gary, Roxy, and Connie. He then married the love of his life, Margaret M. Woodley, in December 1983, which added five more beautiful children, Nancy, Tim, Jeff, Danny, and Christy. Jim loved his beautiful home on Golden Pond and looked forward to the geese coming back every spring. He expressed how fortunate he was daily. Truth be told, the people who were blessed to be a part of his full life were the fortunate ones. His memory will last forever. Louise Ann Doskosil, 95, a resident of Mercy Hallmar, Cedar Rapids, passed away there Sunday morning, June 26, 2022. The funeral mass will be at 10:30 a.m. Saturday at St. Wenceslas Catholic Church by Father Aaron Junge. Burial will follow at St. John's Cemetery. Visitation will be from 4 to 7 p.m. Friday at Papich Kuba Funeral Home East, 1228 2nd Street Southeast, where a rosary begins at 6:30 p.m. Born Louise Ann Chaka on March 17, 1927, to Ernest and Anna Chaka, she was raised on a small farm near Bertram, Iowa. Louise developed a strong work ethic at an early age, completing her daily farm chores while helping raise her younger brother and sister. A graduate of McKinley High School, she met and fell in love with Elmer Doskosil at a ballroom dance in Fairfax, Iowa, and they were proudly married for 67 years as lifelong residents of Cedar Rapids. Serving others was the hallmark of Louise's life. From her childhood years, she carried on and applied her devotion as a nursing assistant to pediatric and adult patients at Mercy Medical Center for the greater part of her adult life. Upon retirement, she continued her service to others as a volunteer at Mercy. Louise developed countless friendships with the sisters and healthcare staff at Mercy, who reciprocated in their tender love and care for her as a resident of Mercy Hallmar during the last 7 years of her life. Virginia L. Glandorf Barr, 89, of Vinton, passed away peacefully on Monday, June 27, 2022, at the Vinton Lutheran Home, with her family by her side. Funeral services will be held at 10:30 a.m. Saturday, July 2, 2022, at Trinity Lutheran Church in Vinton, with the Reverend Stephen Pruss officiating. Interment will be held at Evergreen Cemetery in Vinton. Visitation will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. Friday at the Phillips Funeral Home Chapel, 212 East 6th Street in Vinton. A memorial fund has been established. Virginia was born on June 3, 1933 in Vinton, the daughter of Henry J. and Emma Voss Glandorf. Virginia graduated from Lincoln High School in Vinton. Virginia was united in marriage to Elwin H. Barr on September 28, 1958 at Trinity Lutheran Church in Vinton. Elwin preceded Virginia in death in 2003. The couple farmed and raised their family in Jackson Township, Benton County, and moved to Vinton in 1996. Virginia served as a 4-H leader while on the farm and was very active in her church. She participated in Walther League in her youth and taught Sunday school and midweek school as an adult. She also participated in the choir and served on several ladies' circles at Trinity. Virginia loved knitting and sewing and enjoyed tending her garden. She rarely missed a sporting event where her children and grandchildren participated. Sheldon James Clinton, 84, of Elkader, passed away Saturday, June 25, 2022, at Unity Point St. Luke's Hospital in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. He was born August 4, 1937, in Volga, Iowa, to Vernon and Ruth Bars Clinton. On August 4, 1958, Sheldon married his first wife, Marilyn Nelson. They later divorced. They had three children, Rebecca, Linda, and Jeffrey. Sheldon and Barbara B.J. Stevens met in 1992 and were married on October 7, 2005. A celebration of life will be held at 10 a.m. on Friday, July 1, 2022, at Leonard Grau Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Elkader. A private family burial will follow. In lieu of flowers, the family is requesting that in honor of Sheldon, memorials may be directed to the American Parkinson Disease Association or Hawkeye Seventh-day Adventist Church. Leonard Grau Funeral Home and Cremation Service of Elkader is assisting the family. Lois A. Fettkether, 88, of Williamsburg, passed away Monday, June 20, 2022, at Highland Ridge Care Center, Williamsburg. Per Lois's wishes, her body was donated to the University of Iowa for research. A memorial service will be held at 11 a.m. Friday, July 8, 2022, at the Marengo American Legion, Marengo, with Phil Bushman officiating. The family will receive friends from 10 a.m. until service time at the Marengo American Legion. Memorials may be contributed to the Marengo Senior Dining. Closter Funeral Home Marengo is assisting the family with arrangements. Linda L. Miller, 77, of Cedar Rapids, died Friday, June 24, 2022, in her home. A visitation will be held on Saturday, July 2nd, at the Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home from 10 a.m. to noon. Memorial services and interment to follow at the Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery. Linda was born September 17, 1944, in Mountain View, Missouri, the daughter of James and Mildred Phipps Coberly. She married Douglas R. Miller on October 19, 1963, in Cedar Rapids. Linda worked at Mercy Hospital for many years and most recently was employed at Garnet Place in Cedar Rapids and retired in 2020. Linda enjoyed listening to music, bowling, boating, and camping. She loved spending time with her grandchildren and family the most. Linda will forever be remembered as a delightful and compassionate wife, mother, grandmother, and friend whose memory will be cherished by all who knew and loved her. A memorial fund has been established. Please leave a message or tribute to the Miller family on our webpage, cedarmemorial.com, under obituaries. Mary Pat Lala, 88, of Iowa City, died Sunday, June 26, 2022, at Crestview Specialty Care in West Branch. Her family will greet friends Thursday from 10 to 11:30 a.m. at Lensing Funeral and Cremation Service in Iowa City. A celebration of Pat's life will begin at 11:30 a.m. at Lensing's. Burial will follow in St. Joseph Cemetery in Iowa City. Instead of flowers or plants, the family suggests that memorials be directed to Iowa City Hospice. Born February 8, 1934, in Montgomery, West Virginia, the daughter of Giuseppe Joe and Miranda Palestrini Maiori, Pat grew up in West Virginia and graduated from Montgomery High School. She moved to Iowa City in 1952 to attend the University of Iowa, and one particular day spotted the man who would later become her husband, Vince Valla. The two were married in February 1954 in Iowa City. In addition to raising her children, Pat worked as a nurse's aide and later as a secretary in the obstetrics and gynecology department at University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics, retiring in 1999. Pat always made time for a good game of bingo and would travel all over Iowa and to Las Vegas with Phyllis and Mouse to find them. She was known to wear the black and gold to support the Iowa Hawkeyes, but her favorite time of the year was the fall when she would tailgate and cheer on the Hawks no matter how they were doing. She was a longtime member of Iowa City Eagles Lodge and Iowa City Moose Lodge, Women of the Moose. Verla Dorlina Potratz Mullins died in the early morning hours on Thursday, June 23, 2022, at her home in Center Point, Iowa, of cancer, in the loving care of her nurse daughter, son, and St. Croix Hospice. Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Center Point is assisting the family. Verla was born May 26, 1938, on the family farm between Maynard and Westgate, Iowa. She was the ninth of 10 children, the daughter of Rudolph and Agatha Detmering Potratz, a sister to two brothers and seven sisters. Verla was baptized and confirmed in the Lutheran faith at St. Peter Lutheran Church in Westgate, Iowa, by Pastor Otto C. Schultz. She received her education at St. Peter Lutheran, Harlan No. 1 Country School, during the war years in the 1940s, Maynard High School, and was a 1956 graduate of Fayette High School in Fayette, Iowa, where she was the homecoming queen. Verla attended Capital Business University in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma, and graduated from Kirkwood Community College in 1983 with a liberal arts degree. On June 9, 1956, she was united in marriage to John W. Jack Mullins at Francis E. Warren Air Force Base in Cheyenne, Wyoming. Born to this union were daughters Kelly and Carmen and sons William and Robert. Verla was employed by Farm Bureau Insurance in Fayette and Linn counties, Kelly Temp Services in St. Louis, Missouri, and Eldon Dennison Insurance Agency in Center Point. Her favorite job was taking care of her family as needed during happy and difficult times and being a grandma. Verla was the biggest champion of her children, grandchildren, and family, and her love never faltered through triumphs or travails. She was a faithful and active member of St. John Lutheran Church in Center Point for over 40 years until her health did not permit. Private family services will be held at a later date. A memorial fund has been established. Condolences may be directed to the family at P.O. Box 396, Center Point, Iowa, 52213, and online at murdochfuneralhome.com under obituaries. That ends today's obituaries. We'll move on to today's editorial page. There is one letter to the editor today. It comes from William Mulcahy of Cedar Rapids. The title is Latinos Are Welcome in Iowa. Thank you, Timothy Walsh, for your timely, crucial, and apropos guest column, June 24th, that showcases Meatpacking America, a new book by a professor of religious studies at the University of Iowa, Christy Nabin Warren. I, too, have read this chronicle of the resilience of Iowans and their welcoming of potential and proven very skilled immigrant laborers to our state's meatpacking plants. An article in the Washington Post appeared at the same time. A rural county in Iowa that supported Trump turns to Latinos to grow, May 14th. It recounts how Iowa's Green County is sinking into a demographic hole with waning residents. There, factories have dozens of job openings, schools have closed, and villages are crumbling. Deaths have outpaced births for so long that the hospital stopped delivering babies. This issue is not unique to Green County. Other rural Iowa counties are experiencing the same situation, where falling birth rates, an aging population, and an exodus of young people to the cities have depleted the population. Green County's solution, this mostly white, mostly Republican stronghold, has concluded that the only way to grow is to recruit Latino residents. What a contrast to Iowa's Republican leadership's thoughtless quip about Latinos coming to Iowa. That's the president's problem. And that is, again, a letter from William Mulcahy of Cedar Rapids. There's a guest column today from Zachary Michael Jack. His biography lists him as his most recent book on the Midwest is The Haunt of Home, A Journey Through America's Heartland. The title is Formula Crisis Should Concern All of Us. Critics would have us believe that the recent coverage of the infant formula shortage constitutes a cynical play for the political favor of suburban moms. Yet, as a middle-aged rural Iowan, the crisis concerns me intimately. infant formula likely saved my life as a child. Rural, young, and struggling, my parents had reached their wits' end with me, a colicky, chronically sickly baby in the early 1970s. Vomiting, diarrhea, rash, my particular panoply of symptoms mimicked many other illnesses. At the time, my parents were living in a single-wide trailer in my grandparents' backyard, and the trip to Iowa City, 40 miles distant, to see a specialist was intimidating and costly. As a result of my rapidly declining health, my dad left his job managing a small-town airport in central Iowa to return us to the family farm, hoping support from close-by grandparents would help make me well again. In desperation, my doctor-averse parents reached out to a pediatrician named, hopefully enough, Dr. Maxwell. Dr. Maxwell diagnosed my condition as a serious, potentially fatal milk allergy and instructed my parents to try a commercial infant formula made from soy. More than 40 years later, my mom still credits the formula and Dr. Maxwell with saving my life. Some media pundits prefer to paint today's moms and dads as whiny prima donnas who might solve the formula shortage simply by breastfeeding. Such criticism comes packaged with the wrongful presumptions that all parents are capable of breastfeeding and that all children can safely consume milk. Research shows that lower-income moms are less likely to breastfeed and often lack the time and support enjoyed by their more affluent counterparts. Breastfeeding rates vary dramatically by geodemographics, too, as a recent CDC report card shows. In Iowa, just 54% of parents who begin breastfeeding continue beyond the six-month mark. In Oregon and California, rates of breastfeeding are nearly 20 percentage points higher. Disparities like these suggest that residents of more rural regions like the Midwest and South may suffer disproportionately as shortages continue. Widespread concerns over rising gas and energy prices, coupled with omnipresent supply chain woes, appear likely to overshadow the infant formula crisis. Meanwhile, parents of infants and newborns may be forced to improvise in the face of ongoing shortages and empty shelves, making do with inadequate or unsafe options that may endanger their child's health. Worldwide, UNICEF estimates childhood malnutrition contributes to more than 3 million deaths in children under 5. And according to a 2021 study in the UK, allergies to cow's milk are already the most common cause of fatal reactions in children. My experience suggests that access to good, safe infant formula really can be a matter of life and death. Far from being a partisan ploy or political wedge issue, the infant formula crisis should matter urgently to all who care deeply about the welfare of American families. And again, that is a guest column by Zachary Michael Jack. We have time for one sports article. This is titled, A Clear Conscience. John Deere Classic has no top 50 players, but at least it stands on the right side. By Mike Halas. Silvis, Illinois. The pro golf tournament that will get the most attention this week isn't the PGA Tour's John Deere Classic. For better or worse, and worse is the correct answer, the LIV Golf Invitational Series event outside Portland, Oregon this week will be a far bigger curiosity. The LIV, making its U.S. debut, has Dustin Johnson, Phil Mickelson, Brooks Koepka, Bryson DeChambeau. The JDC does not. The LIV tourney will have 8 of the world's top 50 players. The JDC, 0. If you know the LIV is backed financially by anti-democratic Saudi Arabia Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, if you're quite aware of the atrocities he has authorized against women, gays, journalists, you can't be pro-LIV, unless humanity isn't part of your makeup. All news is local. Zach Johnson is from Cedar Rapids. He is playing in his 20th straight JDC this week and is the captain of the United States 2023 Ryder Cup team. Dustin Johnson, Koepka, and DeChambeau are Ryder Cup veterans and are ranked 17th, 19th, and 31st in the world, respectively. Zach Johnson will get to make 6 captain's picks to fill out the 12-man U.S. team next year. Would he pick an LIV guy or more if allowed? In order to play on the Ryder Cup team, whether you're top 6 or a pick, you must garner Ryder Cup points through the PGA of America, Johnson said here Tuesday. In order to garner Ryder Cup points through the PGA of America, you have to be a member of the PGA of America. The way that we're members of the PGA of America is through the PGA Tour. I'll let you connect the dots from there. In other words, lots of luck, LIV dudes. As for his feelings about them, Johnson had no criticism. I've got some friends that have decided to go that route, he said. A lot of individuals that I'm for. I mean, these are my friends. I'm for them. I want them to do well. I want them to, you know, find contentment or happiness in whatever it may be. It's not for me to say how that develops or how they find that. I will say I have the utmost respect for them individually. I would hope, and I'm not concerned about this, that they would have the respect for me and who I stand for and what I stand for. And I don't think it's very secretive or outlandish in saying that I'm for the PGA Tour. Say what you will about the PGA Tour, it didn't authorize a 15-man hit squad to kill journalist Jamal Khashoggi. Give me the John Deere Classic anytime over that junk in Portland. The JDC has survived for a half century being comfortable with what it is, a tournament for up-and-comers who have up and went. Jordan Spieth got his first tour win when he prevailed here in 2013 and added a second JDC title 2 years later. DeChambeau's first tour triumph was here in 2017, and this was the tourney that gave Zach Johnson two sponsors exemptions before anyone had heard of him, then saw him stay an ever-faithful friend to the JDC. And that does it for today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Wednesday, June 29th, 2022. I'm your reader, Janet Griffith. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thanks for listening.